Good morning. Many of you know that Paul and I left Moorlands College in 2001. What you may not know is that when we left, I was pregnant, and we were looking for a church that would take us on, either a church that had got two posts vacant or a church that were willing to do a job share. And nothing materialised. We waited and we waited and we waited. And then Jess was born, and we continued to wait for this church that would take us on. We waited for so long that I started to ask God, what had we or what had I done to kind of lose that calling into ministry that we had both sensed when we went off to college? It was a wilderness season. We were in a transition. We weren't where we once were. We weren't where we wanted to be. We were in a land between. Some years later, we had a holiday in Italy, an autumn holiday in Italy. It was October time. And one day we went out to this most amazing chestnut forest. It was the most incredible place almost I've ever been. The sun shone through the trees, and they were tall and they were layered because it was on a hillside. And it was so still, all you could hear were the sound of the leaves falling and making their way down into the valley below. Jess and Paul had run on ahead, and I was bringing up the rear. And I just breathed in the majestic of the moment. And it was in that moment that God spoke to me. He said, enjoy autumn. And I just knew that that meant winter was coming. And within a couple of weeks, we'd got back to Tunbridge. Paul had resigned his job, and it seemed like my work life and my home life were just turned upside down. I journeyed through what felt like a winter season for several years. It was another longer transition. It was a much harder land between. And you know, sometimes we're thrown into transition season suddenly. We get a phone call, come to the hospital. Or somebody turns up at the door and says, I've got some bad news. Or your boss says, could you come into my office for a few moments? But you can tell it's not going to be good. Or a spouse confesses, I don't love you anymore. Or you sit down with the consultant and he looks at your test results and then he looks up with a serious look and he pauses before he speaks. These are the kind of conversations that crash into our lives. They drop in like an exploding bomb and they throw us into chaos. Other times, we hit transition almost without noticing it. We don't realize that things are changing until one day we wake up and we realize that the landscape of our lives is completely different. It's changed. Sometimes transition seasons are intentional. We embraced a new vision statement last year, and we're moving towards it. We're not where we once were. We're not where we're going to be. As a church community, we're in a land between. Whatever it is that brings our circumstances about, we find ourselves in this situation. We aren't where we were. We aren't where we will be. Life says, welcome to the land between. And this morning we're starting a new teaching series based on a book by someone called Jeff Mannion. And we're going to dive into the Old Testament. We're going to look at the story of Exodus, when God's people are called out of Egypt, but they haven't yet got into the promised land. We're going to observe how the Israelites handled their wilderness wanderings. and we're going to discover through their story how to find God in difficult transitions. How do we grow in faith when we're living in the land between? Because Jeff Mannion, the author of the book that we're basing this teaching series on, says this: the wilderness where faith can thrive is the very desert where it can die up if we're not watchful. Many of us will be very familiar with the story of the Israelites. They were in slavery to the Egyptians. They were treated horribly and they were treated unfairly. They had a really miserable life. And they cried out to God over and over, God, rescue us. God, save us. And eventually, God answered them in the form of a very elderly shepherd. The shepherd called Moses was told this: I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses was an Israelite who'd been raised in the house of Pharaoh. But 40 years earlier, he'd become a fugitive because somebody had witnessed him beating a man to death. Now, Moses wasn't too keen on God's rescue plan for his people, and he very reluctantly accepted it. But God was faithful, and he took the people out of Egypt. They escaped from Pharaoh and they headed towards the promised land. And I don't know about you, but if God said, come on Astrid, I'm taking you out of here and I'm taking you to there, I would assume it was a fairly short road trip. But for the Israelites, it was one that lasted some 40 years. For 40 years, they would be in a middle land. Now, in my picture here, a little bit of geography. On the, I'm not good at lefts and rights. On this side, you can see this huge, fertile land with the Nile River running down and all the greenery. That's Egypt. And on the right, on the far right of the picture, you can just see at the top the beginning of a fertile land that's called Canaan. But in the middle, it's desert. All of that yellow and brown is hard and barren land. Egypt was full of lush vegetation, as that picture indicates, but it was a place of slavery and of suffering and of agony for the Israelites. Canaan, where they were going, was a place noted for its prosperity. As we've already read, God described it as a land flowing with milk and honey. But to get from the lush place of slavery to the lush place of freedom, they had to travel through this middle space. They had to go through the desert. It was an undesirable place between two more desirable places. This land between was going to be a transforming time for the people of God. But they didn't find it very easy at all. And one of the reasons for this was to do with food. Their diet was restricted. It was restricted to something called manna. It literally means, what is this? Because that's what the Israelites said when they first saw it. What is this? Manna. Manna was like coriander seed and looked like resin. The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into cakes, and it tasted like something made with olive oil. Several church meetings ago, I remember one of my friends, when there was talk about my hours increasing, one of my friends said, and what impact will this have on Jess? And so as we walked home after that day, I spoke to Jess and I said, you know, the church has just agreed to increase my hours. And somebody really kindly said, what do you think impact this might have on Jess? And she just went, oh, does that mean we're going to have more repeats? And by that, she meant, did that mean I was going to cook more of my big pots of food that would go on for day after day after day? She's not ungrateful, far from it, but she does know what food boredom looks like and feels like and tastes like. And if I'm honest, so do I. You know, even if the best meal tasted delicious the first time round, by day three, it's starting to feel a little bit old. But the Israelites hadn't just been eating manna for a day or two, or even day three. Their manna eating went into weeks, and then it went into months, and then it went into years. And they started to grumble and complain. In Numbers we read, now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. All of the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. They were so sick and tired of their diet. Sick and tired of walking around no closer to where they wanted to be. So sick and tired of their circumstances that they had started to look back. Oh, that we had meat to eat. And as they lamented on their misfortune, and as they focused on what they had lost, they were blinded to the future that God had promised them. The desert is a really hard place to be. It's a barren place where nothing grows there except one thing. It can be a fertile place for complaint. You know, they're complaining we were better off in Egypt was really a complaint against God. You know, God, we were better off without you. What about us? What about our lives? What about our circumstances? What is it that we're going through at the moment that says, you know, I am sick and tired of dot, dot, dot. You can fill in your own blanks. If we're currently going through transition, if we're currently in a land between, what is it that's wearing us out? What is it that's draining our energy and draining our joy? As the Israelites journeyed through the wilderness, they demonstrated an entrenched habitual response to hardship. You see, this complaint about manna wasn't the only time that we'll find them complaining. In Exodus 15, we read that they complained about bitter water. That was just 3 days after God had parted the Red Sea for them and miraculously delivered them from the Egyptians. What are we going to drink, Moses, was their grumble on that occasion. And then we have this incident with food. We want meat to eat. And then if we move on into Exodus 17, we find them complaining about water again. God challenges them through the difficult circumstances, not because he's an unkind God, not because he's a difficult God, not because he enjoys playing with them. He wants them to trust him. He wants them to discover what it means to put their faith in him. And as they faced difficult circumstances, they found trusting him more difficult. It was something that they had to learn. There's a bit of a pattern that emerges. Crisis, grumbling, God's provision. Crisis, grumbling, God's provision. God wanted them to learn how to trust his faithfulness. The land between hardships were there to prepare them for life in the promised land. And so it is for us too. When we go through hardships, when we go through our transition seasons, the land between, God is developing a maturity in us. He's inviting us to walk a deeper life of trust with him. He says, you don't have to like this. You don't have to understand this. But trust me, I am a good God. I am a loving Father. But I wonder what the pattern is in us when we go through hard times. What pattern emerges in our lives when things are difficult? Do we complain like the Israelites when we're stuck between a rock and a hard place? Do we actually do any better than them? Or are we able to trust? Are we able to exercise faith? Because you know, how we respond in times of hardship can have a lasting impact on who we are, way beyond the moment of difficult circumstances and those hard times. Complaining when we're in a land between can grow roots of discontent, and it can grow roots of resentment, and it can grow roots of bitterness. It's not fair, becomes the default response. I've counselled people who've been divorced for over 10 years and they still blame their spouse for ruining their lives. I spend time with people who've had a terrible upbringing, such a hard childhood, but they still can't see how they can ever be free from it. And so their upbringing is blamed for not being able to cope with everyday life. Our responses to yesterday's hardships have shaped the people that we are today. And our response in this day to today's hard circumstances will shape the people that we're becoming over the next 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. It's a really sobering thought. Each time I get hurt or burned or betrayed, how I respond is deciding the kind of person I am going to become, because I'm laying down a habit of grumbling or a habit of faith. When we travel through the land between, it's a journey of trust, and we can't always choose the circumstances we find ourselves in, but we can always choose how we're going to respond. I find it very natural to complain. I find it very natural to grumble. And when I catch myself doing it, I have to try and stop. I have to reflect on God's goodness and his faithfulness to me in days gone by. And this helps build in faith and hope for this day. It helps me remember to trust. We can exercise our grumble muscle, or we can exercise our muscle of faith. When I stop and I think back in the past, it reminds me that the God who was good to me yesterday is the same today and tomorrow. We don't get to choose what happens to us all the time. Often we have no control over what other people do in our lives, but we do have control and choice over how we respond and react. We might choose to withdraw emotionally and sink into depression. We might choose seething rage, a volcanic anger boiling just below the surface. We might choose retail therapy or a glass of wine to numb our disappointment, or allow revenge fantasies to fuel us. You know, even if our damaging responses have become so second nature, we don't think we can ever do anything but, can I encourage you not to be fooled by that? We can always, always take small steps to change. The choice of response to difficulty is ours to make. Jeff Mannion says that choice is an opportunity. When we experience severe hardship, our faith is being tested. Our faith is being tested for our good. There is something about facing the hardships experienced in the land between that are faith clarifying. Will we endure trial and still possess a faith that is alive and well at the end of it? Will we journey through the setbacks? Will we journey through the disappointments? Will we journey through the pain and the discomfort, still clinging to the belief that God is good, God is wise, and God is loving? Or will our faith in a good and a wise and a loving God evaporate as our patience grows thin and our spirits tire? Mannion closes the first section of the book that we're going to be looking at saying this: when we choose trust in the face of deep disappointment, complaint has less space to maneuver. And then he puts this into picture language. While attempting to unpack for an extended stay, it, meaning complaint, discovers that trust had taken all of the drawers in the guest... While attempting to unpack for an extended stay, complaint discovers that trust has taken all of the drawers in the guest room and already occupies the empty seat at the table. Trust evicts complaint. It's an interesting picture. Trust evicts complaint. Complaint and trust are not compatible roommates. There's not space for both of them. In our hearts, one pushes out the other. Our question this morning is, which are we going to allow to take root, and which are we going to say, go away? This morning we have been singing about God's faithfulness, about his goodness, about his love, about his presence in times of trouble and in times of challenge. Our songs say it beautifully, and our songs help root these words because music often throws things into our hearts and our spirits, but the Bible also says it well. In Psalm 136, it says, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of gods, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who alone does great wonders, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who by understanding made the heavens, for his steadfast love endures forever." You could join in with me. "To him who spreads out the earth above the waters, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who made the great lights, for his steadfast love endures forever. The suns to rule over the day, for his steadfast love endures forever. The moon and the stars to rule over the night, for his steadfast love endures forever. to him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, for his steadfast love endures forever, and brought Israel out from among them, for his steadfast love endures forever. With a strong hand and an outstretched arm, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who divided the Red Sea in two, for his steadfast love endures forever, and made Israel pass through the midst of it, for his steadfast love endures forever, but overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who led his people through the wilderness, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who struck down great kings, for his steadfast love endures forever, and killed mighty kings, for his steadfast love endures forever. Sihon, king of the Amorites, for his steadfast love endures forever, and Og, king of Bashan, for his steadfast love endures forever, and gave their land as a heritage, for his steadfast love endures forever. A heritage to Israel, his servant, for his steadfast love endures forever. It is he who remembered us in our low estate, for his steadfast love endures forever, and rescued us from our foes, for his steadfast love endures forever. He who gives food to all his flesh, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of heavens, for his steadfast love endures forever. My prayer is for 2018, we will know his steadfast love endures forever.